Of all the memberships we identify ourselves with, the one that is most often forgotten and that has the greatest potential for healing is place. And in the spirit of place, Steve Applebaum and his partner Susan Leonard have found a unique spiritual connection through the love of their land. And over the past 30 years or so, he and she have restored their farms, 80 acres, and he's written a book about it. It's a page-turner, I'm telling you. I got it for the first time last night and read right straight through to the last chapter, and I'm really pleased to have him with us today to talk about restoring and preserving nature, certainly to talk with him about his experiences, and maybe you have some experiences to share, or you may have some questions to share. And if you do, you can join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Steve Applebaum, welcome. Thanks for coming by.
Oh, you're welcome, Larry. Welcome.
Really, really pleased to have you with us, because I really did enjoy your book. Now, you grew up in Chicago, right?
I grew up in the northern, off the edge of the northern suburbs of Chicago in an unincorporated area of Northbrook, and then moved to Arlington Heights in an unincorporated area, and then Freeport, Illinois, which is very close to where we live now on Stone Prairie Farm.
Yeah, you've always been interested in the environment and the outdoors.
Yeah, from a very early age, I don't know what it was that prompted me. There's things that get under one saddle, so to speak, and nature and outdoors was something that was very inspiring for me at a very early age.
And so you studied that?
I did. Both informally, I volunteered at a nature center for about 15 years, and they finally gave me a job. And then through formal schooling, pursued ecology, botany, zoology, and a range of other sciences, yes.
And so the book is kind of about your life in a way.
Yeah, there was never a book intended. This was a journaling exercise where I was just trying to understand what we were doing on the land and the response of the land to the treatments and the management. And I shared a couple of essays with a former professor and wonderful friend, Luna Leopold, Eldo Leopold's son. Mm-hmm. And he encouraged me to think about writing a book. And this was in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And then I brought him back a draft of the book in the early 90s. And he said, "Oh, this is just awful. You probably shouldn't consider writing books." And he suggested it was three books in one and needed focus. And I learned about something called a book doctor, and in contrast to a medical doctor where they take your temperature, I met a book doctor who took my temperature and helped me improve as a writer, and this book is one of the products of that process.
Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful book. You, your farm, you really started when you were kind of out of school, if I'm not mistaken, and you and your mom.
Yeah.
Looked around. You wanted a place.
Yeah, that's right. My mother was encouraging me to move into the normal apartment in the normal suburb, and I wanted nothing to do with that. And I was intent on finding a place in the country where I could work with the land, grow food and restore the health of the land and reintroduce wildlife and a whole range of things like that, work with local neighbors, farmers, and so forth. My mom was incredibly instrumental, and at the time I was kind of frustrated by the experience because I couldn't find a place that was affordable or a place that, had the basic inspirational elements that I was after. Most everything I looked at was basically scraped bare of life. It was corn or it was soybeans, nothing wrong with those, that's obviously life, but none of the wildlife and the native plants that I was excited about. So after expressing frustration for weeks and weeks on end, going out and looking at farms, handyman specials, some were called, I put some money down and was never enough, and the offer was never accepted. My mom took this cause up and volunteered to help me find a place to live. And this was one of the farms of the many that we visited, and this place struck me because it didn't have anything to do with what was on this property. There was a native prairie remnant right across the street within eyeshot, and then this wonderful spring that was on this property right next to the old farmhouse. And while Mom was looking at the farmhouse and thinking about living conditions, I was out looking at nature and anyways, that's how the story begins.
Banged your head on a water cup right next to the...
I did. There was a little stick in the ground with one of those blue metallic glasses, you know, metal glasses hanging above the spring. And I banged my head on it, and it clunked to the ground, and I got the hint that this was drinkable water, and the story continues from that first drink.
So you had two and a half acres or something like that just to start.
Yeah, the owner, one of my mom's friends from Chicago, had committed to selling 5 acres, but when they found out 5 acres was bigger than the basic yard around the buildings, they learned that it impinged on or infringed on a farm lease that was associated with the rest of the 80 acres. So they cut me back to a little more than 2.5 acres, which was an okay start. You know, big ambitions don't necessarily align with capacity, and I learned about having to learn about to work with larger pieces of property.
And you started a business, was it about the same time, wasn't it? Or
the business Applied Ecological Services started in 1975 when I was at University of Illinois. I had a professor that approached me about some ecological inventory work for the U.S. Army at military bases all over the U.S. and other parts of the world, and that's how the business started.
And you work, and you that business continues, obviously, after all these years. And talk about that a little bit, because that relates to the story here.
Yeah, there's two parallel tracks. There's the business where professionally I'm learning at different scales about the complexity of working with people, mostly people, but the focus was on land and how to restore land, but it always involved engaging people and working through the politics and the governance and the financial side, the regulatory side. But the company established as doing ecological research and ecological restoration projects starting in the mid-70s. Now there's 7 offices around the U.S. and a couple of international offices, and around 140 staff. And the main office is, I'm proud to say, here in Wisconsin. It's near Broadhead, Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And the business kind of plays a role in the establishment of your farm, in a way, because you wound up getting the rest of the land.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, both formally and informally. It wasn't unusual before they changed the locks and didn't give me the key for me to wander over and borrow a tractor once I learned how to use tractors and other equipment. And then also prescribed burning, while it is something that I've always wanted to do on my own with Susie and other neighbors. It doesn't take but a case of beer and a kettle of spaghetti to get staff over from Applied Ecological Services to help do the burning, and it's proven to be much safer to have more than 2 people burning 80 acres.
As you note in your book, we can talk about that a little later.
Yes, that's good. That fire almost went perfectly, Larry. It was just the last 5 minutes that didn't go so well.
We'll maybe get to that. But, you know, one of the things that that impresses me as about the book is how you've been able to heal the land, but also it's not something that one does overnight.
Yeah, young people like me, when I first inhabited this farm, wanted things to happen overnight, and you're so right. This healing process is one of patience and one of endurance. It's a track. A track meet, and nature is running the long course, and taking time and winning over time. The seeds that we planted early, the plants that we planted early, took many years to show up in many cases, and I've had to learn patience. It's been an incredible experience, just to be patient and work with the land rather than at my pace expect results.
And at about the same time, if I'm not mistaken, about the same time as you were purchasing the rest of the land, you also purchased another farm to really help your business.
It turned out that I was running Applied Ecological Services out of the same farmhouse I was trying to live in, and it was a great experience before a family came into my life. And with the family, it just wasn't prudent, and it didn't work out too well. So we looked for another farm, purchased one right down the road, and that's where Applied Ecological Services' main office is.
And turned out to be a sort of a useful way to help your own farm.
It did, from a couple of perspectives. Having AES staff at our farm when the office was there, it was very helpful. But then also providing some distance, they would come back. We would all work together on our property and on our farm, and then on the nursery associated with Taylor Creek Restoration Nurseries, which is Applied Ecological Services Nursery.
Our guest today, Steve Applebaum, author of Nature's Second Chance, Restoring the Ecology of Stone Prairie Farm. Really pleased to have him with us today. It's published by Beacon Press, his book. If you'd like to join in with a question or comment, let me give you the numbers to do that. It's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You did a lot of research on your land before you. I think, by the way, that your partner played a big role in that whole effort.
That's correct. As a trained scientist, I was trying to understand as much as possible about the history of the land and about the changes that had occurred on the land from a botanical perspective, a hydrological perspective, and so on and so forth. So what I learned, though, was the book learning that I learned in college didn't quite position me for the education that I needed and the experience that I needed to explore and understand the farm. So what I did to learn about the farm was quite a bit of oral history, working with the elderly people in the neighborhood, learning about what used to be present on the land from them and also from historic aerial photographs and maps. And then direct measurements, coring the trees and determining their age, their growth rates, and a whole series of things. And then doing the same with the soil and looking at changes in the soil systems over time.
You tell a great story about a guy who shows up on your property one day, and you get into a discussion, and he had lived there himself. Tell that story.
Yeah, actually, Howard was born on the farm in our present room where we just store stuff. It's a small little 8-foot by about 8-foot room, and that was the bedroom he was born in. I was working, doing some woodworking out in the front yard, and this man, very genteel, very large man, pulled in, very coy, looked at me out the window and tipped a hat and stepped out and asked if I was the person that lived in the farm, and that conversation went on for about 8 hours. He had so much to share about the history of the house, the history of the land, you know, how his family worked the land, and it was an amazing experience. And you know, as I've thought about it over the years, and by the way, he has never come back. Mm-hmm. I believe he's passed away. Nobody knows of him except a couple of elderly neighbors that have also passed away. It was a remarkable experience to have a window into the past that I could not have gotten in any other way.
And I bet you sometimes wish that he could be back now to see the farm.
Well, I do. I have so many questions that have come up. And, you know, and I was a young person and he was in his 80s. And I probably overwhelmed him with young person questions. And what I feel was happening in that experience with him was he was kind of saying his final goodbye to the land. He had tried gaining access to the old house that he was born in for, he told me, about 25 or 30 years, and he was never able to gain access because the former owners, before I bought the land, were absentee, and he never could coordinate with travel and presence at the farm. So it was a very interesting experience to me, and in retrospect, a very powerful experience.
Steve Applebaum, our guest today, as we talk about his new book, Nature's Second Chance. If you'd like to join in, give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about understanding, restoring, and preserving nature as it is expressed in the book written by Stephen Applebaum called Nature's Second Chance. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. And I have to say that your book has... Well, for one thing, the profits from your book are going to a great cause, I think.
Yeah, 25% of the proceeds from the book, Larry, are going to the Elder Leopold Foundation, and the remaining 75%, if I've done my math correct, are going into a research and educational fund for basically encouraging restoration and ecosystem management.
That's wonderful. And it's I should also mention that your book has had some great New York Times reviewed it, and
that's correct. It's been reviewed in probably a dozen major newspapers and magazines, including the New York Times home section about a month ago, and it's starting to, with humility. I've been a technical writer, a science writer. I've not written books of this nature before, nonfiction books, but it's also starting to win some accolades, awards, and so forth.
Yeah, that's just great. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in because all of our lines are filled. So let's go to Greg in Sister Bay first. Greg, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Well, my question is in relation to the mega farms. Long before the swine flu epidemic started, groups such as PETA and so forth had been saying that these constant giving animals these antibiotics is going to eventually create a, super virus. And I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on mega farms, and what are some of the, what you consider to be the dangerous things about these mega farms?
All right. Thanks for calling, Greg.
Well, I think the, resistance to antibiotics, which you've brought up, is certainly a concern, not just for our the animals that are in the wild, but also food organisms that we consume, plants and animals. I think that, the local community decisions about capos or mega farms, whatever you want to call them, is something that, people should take real seriously and get involved in the conversation about such projects. Large parts of the world are going toward large capos and mega farms. And designing those correctly, if they are in fact acceptable within the politic and governance of the local communities and ordinance structures, is something to really pay a lot of attention to make sure we're doing them right if we're going to take that sort of strategy. We have several that have moved into our neighborhood in Greene County, Wisconsin, and I know there are neighbors that don't feel particularly compelled and excited about these projects. We have simply been trying to be objective and learn about how well or not so well they do. And then we've been providing feedback to regulators and policymakers about what we're learning in our neighborhood.
And your farm, as you write in your book, has had an impact on your neighbors.
It has indeed. We've had it's always surprising to learn about farmers that are neighbors. The first experience was our farm didn't look quite as tidy and neat rows when we planted prairie and wetland and savanna vegetation. So I'd sit down in a local cafe and people would address me as the guy growing the weed farmers. and later on, though, when the flowers and the wildlife habitat benefits became realized, the opinions completely changed within the neighborhood. We've had weddings on the prairie. We've had school groups, farmers, neighboring farmers, and other community members come by regularly to walk the trails. It's been a very interesting experience to see how the neighborhood and the community have responded.
Greg, thanks a lot. Nelson and Madison, I want to give you a chance. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you. Steve, it's Nelson Eisman, and you know I'm familiar with your work, Applied Ecological Services, and I've been down to the farm to visit you and Susan. But and I have a question. My question is, I mean, just haul over 100 bags of garlic mustard out of local park. Well, why do we go after these weeds? Why can't we just trust nature to sort these things out?
Well, that's a wonderful question, Nelson, and I can picture you sweaty with those bags of garlic mustard. What of you? I think the answer that I give myself is historically, nature adjusted. We had there was time for plants and animals to adjust. Co-evolve is a term that a lot of people use. What we've done is we've introduced everything from bacteria and viruses to invasive birds and mammals and ants and spiders and garlic mustard. And maybe in the long term, nature would adjust. However, what we're seeing is that virtually each one of these plant animal in introductions is unfamiliar to the healthy ecological systems, the native plant and animal communities that we had here on our Wisconsin landscape previously. And the changes that are occurring in those native healthy plant and animal communities as a result of these invasive species are happening very, very quickly. Indicators of ecosystem health, just general indicators such as stable soil systems and clean water, and biodiversity and the landscape, those simple indicators are being defiled and are changing very, very quickly. In other words, the soil is becoming unstable, the water not so clean and clear, and biodiversity is being depleted. So when we see those indicators of ecosystem health being declining as a result of these invasives, we have reason to pause and think about what to do, just like we do in our own body when we're invaded by a bacteria or a virus. We certainly don't think twice about addressing that. We might think twice about the method we're going to use, but we take action usually.
And you talk in your book, there's you have a chapter on invasives, as a matter of fact, in your book. And And you even talk about even sometimes people with good intentions don't do everything the way they probably should, or for the best interests of the land or the area.
It's been really interesting. The majority of the invasive plants in North America have been inadvertently introduced through horticultural or agricultural, intentions. So plant A is installed in field A, and it doesn't just stay put, it moves. So the unintentional consequences of these introductions is what we're paying for. Some of the major responsibilities associated with introducing many particular plant species have been associated with our agronomic and agricultural communities. Our federal agencies, for example, certainly have quite a long list of responsible species that they've introduced. And now the unintentional consequences are, costing billions and billions and billions of dollars annually to eradicate, to eliminate, to manage, to control those species.
Yeah. Nelson, thank you very much for calling. I want to give Maggie a chance in Blue River. Maggie, hi to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi. What a wonderful program. I wanted to say two things. One was that so much of the land is in private hands over the whole country. And private landowners, whether you have an acre or 100 or 1,000 acres, is in our hands. And I think that it's so important to remember that every time that we humans move into the landscape, we're mowing lawns and probably cutting down unsightly things and And if we could only change our minds about things and let wildlife back into our landscapes, into our hearts, it would be wonderful. It would be a huge impact. And the other thing I wanted to say was that people out in Southwest Wisconsin on June 27th, mark the date, June 27th, have an opportunity to hear Steve talk up near Lafarge at the reserve for a benefit for Valley Stewardship Network. And for further information, you can go to our website, which is kickapoovsn.org. And I can't wait to meet you and read your book, Steve.
Well, thank you very much. I can't say, I can't express in words. I've tried in writing, but your focus on the heart and the spiritual side of the response and recovery of land is really closely aligned with the, you know, the feelings and experiences that we humans have. We have watched wildlife come back, fish come back to a wonderful, now restored stream, and birds that fly literally from, you know, Argentina to seek out our farm and come back every year to our farm. There is an amazing opportunity here to stitch yourself to a vast network of, you know, a global network of opportunity through wildlife and fish and so forth and so on. And it's very, very endearing and engaging.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. And you can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you as we visit with Stephen Applebaum about his book, Nature's Second Chance, Restoring the Ecology of Stone Prairie Farm. And great talking with him today. But give us a call with your questions. Mary Lou in Minocqua, by the way, is called. Let's go to Mary Lou. Hi, Mary Lou.
Well, good morning. This is a very coincidental program because just yesterday we were looking right in Steve's neighborhood right there in the Broadhead area for a farm. And the farm that we have looked at, we're very interested in, 40 acres of it has already been given over just within the last year or so to the Wetlands Reserve Program. And I'm not at all familiar with that program. I'm wondering if Steve has any comments or ideas or suggestions as to his involvement with that.
Mm-hmm. I can give you a thumbnail sketch. It's a wonderful program to take land that's flood-prone, historic wetland, and convert it back into wetland. However, as with many government programs, the program offers minimums. So if you're interested in diverse, really diverse, healthy, restored landscapes, you'll get partway back through the Government Enrollment and Wetland Reserve Program. However, I would encourage that as a way to get partway back, but make sure your contract with the NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Services, allows for you to do some of the management practices that would help you get much further than partway back and restore the land further. For example, prescribed burning and a range of other practices, including enriching, planting more diversity than what the government program will pay for.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm concerned about, is the control that I would be losing and the things that I would like to do in addition, as planting, things like that.
Yeah, I'd go meet with the county NRCS conservationist and talk about what your goals are. And what we've been able to do with groups like the Nature Conservancy that obviously have broader, higher biodiversity goals than minimums, is we've been able to craft WRP contracts that allow for conservation-focused management rather than just deferred agricultural use type management on the land. And if you need examples of those contracts, if you do become a neighbor, or if not, just let me know and I can send you a copy of the contracts we've worked on with Nature Conservancy.
Great. That would be a big help. Yes, because we're real seriously interested in this farm. It's a sweetie pie, so maybe it'll happen.
All right, Mary Lou.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much for calling. Do you have some of that information up on your Applied Ecological Services website, Stephen?
Larry, the website has, I haven't looked at it in a long time, but there's typically about 100 or more downloads that have examples of ecosystem restoration projects and a whole range of other documentation that people can download. I don't have that client you know, privileged document up on the website. Sure. But if people are interested, I can get permission to share it with them.
You know, it must be a wonderful life for you, because this is something you're really passionate about, and you've been able to do it on your own farm and then in your business and make a living doing this.
It's a joy not having – well, it's a joy and sometimes not so joyful not being able to separate personal and professional life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, passion and advocation are one and the same in my life, and I can't think of any other way to do it personally. There is no 8 to 5. It's about looking out for nature every day in any way I can.
Well, Jackie in Sun Prairie has a question for you, so let's go to Jackie. Hi, Jackie.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have been in and out of farming many years, and have seen a lot of people trying to bring back sections of farms and sections of, you know, 5 or 10 acres even back to some type of original ecology. And I love plants and birds and animals, of course, too. But I find that a lot of times the animals or the wildlife that comes back isn't necessarily the stuff that I want to have come back, you know, like anything from gophers that eat the lettuce. I have a small garden to the raccoons who killed the geese. I don't mind the coyotes, however, howling in the distance, but it is a bit disconcerting, you know, to get up in the morning, feed the geese, and finding the feathers and the bones hanging up in the tree.
All right. Well, you've got some thoughts on that, Steve. You write about that a little bit in the book.
Well, welcome to membership in the land community, first of all. My advice is plant a little extra lettuce for the gophers, and you'll get some perhaps, and figure out how to offer what protection you can to your geese beyond what you can't have a laissez-faire attitude toward geese if you're going to restore land and then have geese. Or other, you know, rabbits, for example. The wildlife that have come back on our place are extraordinary. Surveys we did in 1980 and 81, when I first moved to the farm, about 113 plant species on the 80 acres. And now there's over about 340, if I recall. One fish species that we found, and it was a white sucker that had run, had tried coming, you know, 5-6 miles up this little stream, and was so emaciated by the time it made it to our farm that it never spawned and had no friends to spawn with. Now we've got 5 or 6 wonderful species that have moved up into the stream, including those associated with native headwater streams. And the birds that have come back are just extraordinary. Everything from rare Henslow sparrows, short-billed marsh wrens, upland plovers is what I call them. Some people call them upland sandpipers. Mm-hmm. A whole range of rare birds, and then not-so-rare birds have come back. And we had our bout with trying to raise chickens, so we understand. the fox and the skunk won every time, and we gave up on chickens.
One other thing I should say is that I had lived on a piece of acreage of 5 acres, half lawn, half just letting it go wild. And then we eventually got it down to an acre of lawn, you know. And the interesting thing is that we suddenly found these wildflowers coming back, like yellow-toothed dog, dog-tooth.
Trout lily, yellow trout lily.
Yeah, and then we found Dutchman's breeches, you know, which had not been there when we bought the property.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
And that's what we've learned as well, that when you give nature a second chance, nature will respond, and nature will come back in some ways, but needs help. It can't come back quickly or in some ways without our help.
Jackie, thank you. I want to give Kurt a chance to join in from Springbrook. Kurt, thank you for calling. Hello.
Yeah, I was. I'm fascinated by the work your guest is doing, and I own 32 acres, and we're starting to restore some acreage on it. But I'm also involved in some activism, and I do a lot of reading of history, and I'm wondering how your guest handles the fact that we have an economy that has to keep growing, otherwise it'll collapse. and which, of course, you know, is based on, it's an extractive economy. It has to turn resources into products. And our population, you know, we don't ever talk about how we have to stop growing our human population because we're taking over ecosystems. So I'd like to know how he deals with it, doing the work that he does, and because I feel sure. kind of a sorrow in it.
Sure.
Well, actually, you've hit on an incredible opportunity, and the opportunity that we've focused on for 30-some years now at Applied Ecological Services is figuring out how to make conservation pay, showing value for ecosystems and the services that ecosystems provide. There's a couple of chapters in the book that talk about places we've worked on where we've integrated ecology, economy, and culture, and I'll give you a real quick specific.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's a project in Grays Lake, Illinois, called Prairie Crossing. It's a residential development project, but with big differences. The development could have been 700 acres in size. It's far less. It's about one-fifth, one-sixth that size, and the rest of the land has been fully protected for agricultural production. And also for restored landscape uses. We've used this development as an economic engine to help leverage protection of an adjacent, just under 6,000 acres of land, which is also being restored. So the way we've done it with that example and others in the book is we've basically used development and we've used the revenue streams that can be associated with development to finance ecosystem restoration. And then we've used new revenue streams associated with the restored landscapes to basically leverage additional conservation. And there's a whole range of examples that I could give, but no time right now, but maybe the book will help enlighten a few of those other areas for
yeah.
you.
Yeah, I hope you have a chance to take a look at the book, Kurt.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. So the book has what'd your partner think of the book?
Well, it's real interesting. Susan didn't really read it until after it was done. I tried encouraging her to read a few essays, and she did. But you know, I wasn't that good of a writer when I started, and it was probably pretty boring. Now both she and our son Noah are delighted with the book. They would probably like to tell the story from their perspective, but too bad I wrote the book.
Yeah. And is Noah working in this field too as well?
He was working with Applied Ecological Services, but he followed some nice young sweet thing down to Phoenix and is not in this field any longer.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's a real page turner. I'm telling you, you start reading it, and just your life experiences have been wonderful. So you learn, you know, it's you learn about ecology, and you learn about restoration, but you also learn about family life, and it's real compelling reading.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's real compelling writing too.
Well, I tell you what, it's been a real pleasure. I thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For being with us today, and hopefully we can visit again.
I'd look forward to it. I'd be delighted.
Thank you so much. Stephen Applebaum is the author of Nature's Second Chance, Restoring the Ecology of Stone Prairie Farm. It's published by Beacon Press. Stone Prairie Farm, by the way, located near Judah, Wisconsin. And, you know, I bet you could probably find some more information about it at Applied Ecological Services. Go to their website. If you just put in Applied Ecological Services, you're going to find that. But also, the book is a wonderful read, and I hope you will have a chance to take a look at it. You know, one of the things that's great about this time of the year and right on through now until the ice comes back to us is canoeing and kayaking. It's a wonderful way to spend time, and we'll be talking about that now with Darren Bush, who is the owner of Rutabaga, the world's largest paddle sport shop. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.